I remember pretty vividly the feelings when Justin and I first became parents. It's a unique experience. Maybe many of you have maybe even had the kind of experience where, right, when you first bring your kids home, like it's a terrifying moment. Right, because I remember distinctly with all three of our kids, Eli, Emmy, Alice, there's a moment, like you have a couple days in the hospital where it's like, all right, it's all good. Like you don't have to worry about anything. Like if you don't want to change a diaper, you don't have to. Like and tip for anybody who hasn't had a kid yet, if you just ask, they will do it. Like know that going in. But once it's time to go home, like there's not like a test or anything to make sure that you're qualified. I don't know if you know that. Like they let anybody become a parent and anybody gets to take a kid home. The only, like as long as you have the car seat, like you're good to go. Like that's it. Like that's the one thing on the list. And I remember the closest parallel experience that I could connect it to is like, before I had kids, I remember the first time I ever drove a new car out of a dealership. Like I remember pulling out on the Van Dyke and like, oh no, like now it's real bad if something goes wrong. Like that's the feeling when you take your kid home. Like there's no instruction manual. It's like just you and Google or now ChatGPT. And it's like, you just got to figure it out. Like you got to figure out why they're crying. You got to figure out like what, and then like you got to help them become fully functioning humans. And the verdict's still out, whether or not we're successful on that. I'm sorry, they're here. But what a wild thing. But there's also something I think really special as a parent when we get to bring our kids home, because one of my favorite things has been slowly over time, and it happens really, really quickly, that you begin to get to see who your kids are. And what's really fascinating, like, Jess and I haven't really changed our personalities from one kid to the next, yet all of our kids are very different from one another. We got to witness that we generally parent the same way, we've kind of raised them all in a similar fashion, yet all of them we got to watch, they're unique, they're each different, they each have different gifts and talents and passions. And so I remember the joy of watching just from early ages, like at 1 and 2, seeing the imagination and creativity, the nonstop smile and love, the joy, the dreams and silliness and sass, like getting to see all of those things early, early on. It's one of the most special things as a parent to be able to begin to witness your kid becoming who God already formed them to be. Our family's also pretty obsessed with football. I've always liked football growing up, but it's only in the past few years that our family started watching football together. And we had a unique experience a couple years ago. We were able to go to our first Lions game together. It was an incredible game. We got to go. It was when the Lions played the Vikings for the one seed. And so, like, kind of peak level environment that we got to experience. But there's something about being at the field that I've noticed, and that's really true of any sports, that there is a distinct advantage when a team plays at home. And in football, it's wildly noticeable because of the volume in the place, because of the way it can throw another team off. It happens, though, in any sports, that there's something that happens when you play at home. Because when you play at home, it's where you're most familiar with. It's where you're most comfortable with. You go through the same routines, the same patterns. It's where you've practiced. It's where your friends and your family are. It's playing in a place where you're known and loved instead of the villain. Right? All of these end up being factors that the volume at the home field is on your side instead of working against you. And there's something about being at home that it brings out the best. A team in their home environment is most set up to play to the vision that the coach has set before them. Why? Because everything is exactly the way they prepared. Everything goes according to a plan because you can control the music that you're going to listen to. You can control the locker room that you're going to come out of. You know all of these things and you're prepared for them. It brings a competitive edge because you're in the comfort and experience of home. And I think it's interesting when we think about what it looks like for us to have a relationship with God, because often the metaphor that is used is being at home. To be at home in a relationship with God. And certainly there are times where that metaphor falls flat. Because maybe for some of you, home didn't feel like a safe place. It didn't feel like a place where you were loved or seen or loved. But what I do think is even if you didn't have that experience growing up, most of us could point to some place where we felt at home. that maybe for you, you had a teacher you felt at home with, a teacher who saw something in you that no one else did, a teacher who you could trust and talk to. Maybe a coach who, like, they pushed you hard, like it was tough love, but they saw something in you that no one else did, and you felt at home, and it brought something out in you. Maybe like I did, you got to experience that in your home. A love that saw something and brought out the best in you. Today, we're beginning a series called Coming Home. It's a series about being our true selves, a series about being at our best. It's about our identity, who God created us to be. And so we're going to spend 3 weeks in one of the more familiar parables. It's the parable of the prodigal son. But in it, what I want to dive into is a deep dive into our identities. What does it look like for us to be at home in our relationship with God? To be in a place where we see what the Father sees. To be in a place where we have the competitive edge, the advantage of being in a place where we are known and loved and safe. To see God as a Father who's brought out the best in us. There's an incredible book that inspired a lot of the ideas in this series. The book's called Coming Home to Your True Self by Albert Hassey. And he described the concept by saying this. He said, the great tragedy for many of us is that in growing up, we become self-made, independent successes who are weighed down with thoughts of the past and worries about the future. We lose touch with our true self. The person God created us to be. We live off-center and alienated from who we really are. For you and I, as we grow, as we get older, as we experience the pains, the difficulties, the trials, we often move further and further away from home, further and further away from who we truly are. If you could open your Bibles to the book of Luke chapter 15, we're going to spend some time in the first half of the story. Now, as we talk about it, my sense is as we dig into this story, you might find yourself in a couple different possible places. One is some of you will have trouble knowing who you are because you're stuck in the past. And to be stuck in the past means that maybe it's something you regret. That you look back and that thing is stuck there, that you go back to that moment, you go back to that hurt, that pain, that broken relationship. Maybe it's something you said, a relationship you lost and you can't help, but looking back and that defines the way you understand yourself. Maybe it's something you're ashamed of, something that you know is back there that you hope doesn't ever come out in the present. Or maybe it's not something you said or did. Maybe it's something that somebody said or did to you, a label somebody gave you and now continues to haunt you today. Or maybe somebody who claimed to follow Jesus said something or did something and that's brought with you all kinds of pain and baggage that makes you want nothing to do with Jesus. And so all of this has you stuck in a place back there looking back, maybe even wishing you could change the past, yet missing what's happening in the present moment. Now, others of us don't go back. Some of us actually end up trapped in the future. That instead of having our identity rooted in yesterday, it ends up tied to tomorrow. That we find ourselves worried about, well, what if? What if this or what if that? What could go wrong? We find ourselves trying to prepare for, plan for all the possible scenarios in order to protect us from a fictional life that hasn't actually even happened. Or we live as though, well, one day I will become this. I remember the experience in high school often being told, like, you got to figure out what you want to do with the rest of your life. And the tension in that was always like the tension of saying, you figure out what you're going to do down the line as though today doesn't actually matter. And so I remember having the feeling like I can't wait till I'm an adult so then I can really fulfill God's calling. So I could really be who God made me to be. Which misses all that God has in the present moment. The problem with being stuck in the past or trapped in the future, both of them miss the present. The story of the prodigal son is the story of two sons who miss the present moment. The story of two sons who at time end up stuck in their past. Ashamed of the mistakes, ashamed of their decisions, ashamed of their rebellion, and at other times, trapped and tied to a future that does not exist, but ultimately on the present love of their father. And so I want to start reading in Luke chapter 15. I'm going to start in verse 11. It says this, Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. And when he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired men have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men.' So he got up and went to his father. While he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring a fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He is lost and now found.' So they began to celebrate." Just to highlight a few basics of the story, when the younger son says to his father, "Give me my share of the estate," this is not like a simple inheritance request. This is not like the father has a spreadsheet and he's like, "Oh, I'm just going to mark it down this much," and he just doesn't get it at the end. That's not, like, it's not just a simple, like, dollars and cents kind of conversation. This is detrimental to their relationship. It's offensive. It's harsh. He's telling his father, "I'd rather you be dead. You're more useful to me then." And so the son here is stuck in the future. He's looking ahead and he's like, "Well, if only I had more money, if only I had the freedom that I could do whatever it is that I want, if only my life looked different than it did now, things would be different. I would be proud of myself. I would be content. I would be happy. I would have peace. If only that." And what does he miss? He misses what he actually already has with his father. And so the son takes the money. The father gives it to him. He takes off and he uses it all. Now, depending on our cultural background, there are different things you might pick up on as you read the text. The tendency would be, in the West, we generally focus on the phrase "wild living." Our tendency is, as we read the text, we notice that. And it's an important thing to highlight, because what does he do when he gets the money? He just spends it all, fulfilling every sense of desire and pleasure that he can find. And the phrase is meant to highlight the sin. He's living it up. He's partying, hooking up, doing whatever his heart desires without any regard whether it's good for him or the people around him. No sense of who gets hurt. Now, the tendency in other cultures in the East would be, it's more common that people actually notice the phrase, "There was a severe famine in the whole country," which is a phrase that for many of us, we might overlook, because we just get focused on the phrase "wild living." But there's also an important thing here that we should notice, is there's also wasteful living. That as he has all of these resources to make the decisions and do whatever he wants, more than he certainly needs in this moment, there is a severe famine in the whole country, and he just wastes it. Like, he could have used it to have the necessary food for his survival. He could have taken care of other people, but he lived in a way with no sense of what would be the best way to use the gifts that he actually had. And then he ends up there eating with the pigs, which for all of Jesus' listeners, they had no question that this was the lowest it could get. Nothing worse. And I can't help but think, like, in that moment when he is eating with the pigs, does he begin to move like he was living trapped in a future that he was trying to write for himself? And does he now shift, end up stuck in the past? Like, "Oh, like, if only I did this," regretting his decisions, regretting the conversation he had with his father, realizing that some of the decisions and some of the ways he used his money actually got him into that pig pit in the first place. And then the text tells us he came to his senses. I love that phrase. In fact, one translation even says he came to himself. It's like he's in the pig pit and all of a sudden he realizes who he really is. He's in the pig pit and all of a sudden something knocks him out. He was trapped in the future. He ended up at moments stuck in the past, and then something suddenly brought him back to the present and he realized. And I think that happens for all of us. That we end up living our lives in a way that we lose ourselves. That we put on a facade of ourselves. We make choices we don't want, or we make choices that we think will make the people around us happy. We get stuck in a situation that we don't know how to get out of. And so maybe we could define it like wild living, that we're just living and doing whatever we want in a way that hurts us or others. Maybe you could define it as wasteful living, that you're missing an opportunity to live the way that God created you. In all of it, what happens? You miss who you really are. You miss the peace of being who God created you to be. You miss the opportunity to use your gifts. For some of us, we're missing the present moment because we're stuck in the past, that we look back and we see some things that we regret. And it hurts to know the ways that we have hurt other people. We look at the addictive patterns that have formed and we don't know how to get out, and so we look and it's stuck. We can't help but replay words that were said to us and labels that were given to us, and they continue to haunt us. And maybe what Jesus is inviting you to today is to come to your senses. He's asking you to leave that place in order to come to yourself. And maybe for some of you, you're stuck in a version of life that hasn't even happened yet, that you are waiting for it to eventually one day arrive, or you're planning for it all to go wrong, and you're trying to prepare for the possible scenarios. And Jesus, maybe he's asking you to come back to the present moment, to realize what he's invited you to right now, to be who he has made you to be. In the book by Albert Sassy that we referenced earlier, he gives a list of what he calls the empty P's of the false self. And so he lists out 9 different things that pull us away from the true self. I think you could actually map all of these onto the 2 sons in the story. That all of these can be at different moments ways that we deal with not knowing who we really are. They're ways that take us to the past, ways that take us to the future, all ways that ultimately avoid the present. And so he lists these: pleasure, praise, power, prestige, position, popularity, productivity, possessions, perfection. All of them become distractions from who God says you are. Pleasure is the emotional fix. Right, it's what we could easily attach to wild living in the story. It's the cheap thrill. It's a form of diversion and entertainment, which is not in and of itself a bad thing, but often becomes an unhealthy way of denying the reality of life. When used outside of the bounds that God gives us, it becomes a way of diverting ourselves from pain, avoiding reality, without ever actually learning to be present. Praise is the version of life where we often rely on somebody else's approval to feel better about ourselves. And praise can give the appearance of being happy and fun-loving when in reality it is completely dependent on another person. Often praise can be a way that maybe at some point in our life we didn't get the praise, and so now we subconsciously live for the praise of others because maybe I didn't have the approval giving growing up. Or maybe I didn't have the approval that I wanted from my coaches, and so now I live in a way like I'm always performing. Power, prestige, and position are all an emotional need to be king of the hill. Because for some of us, when we don't know who we are, well, at least if I have the title, or at least I have the letters after my name, at least there are people who report to me, at least I have the title, the influence. It's also probably the easiest to see how corrupted it can become. You just look around our world, and what happens when we have a need for power? It will override our ability to make good or godly decisions. Popularity is the emotional need to be liked. Similar to praise, it seeks the approval of others. Where praise is attached to what we do for people, popularity is generally attached to, are we likable? Questions that often start early on, like, do you like me? Am I okay? Am I acceptable? And so instead of being content with who we are constantly looking at what does somebody else think of us. Productivity is the need to keep cranking out more and more work, because if we can crank out more work, if we are more productive, then we must also be needed. And if we're needed, we're worthwhile. If we can produce, then we will be respected and admired. And many of us, maybe we're highly productive people, which is celebrated all around us, but maybe many of us are highly productive because we're insecure, avoiding the present moment of understanding who God says we are, because we don't know. Possessions is a way that often we deal with our poor self-images. And that self-image can come because you're trying to look a certain way, like fit a version of a story in the future that the world around you has told you to look. Or your poor self-image has come because somebody said or did something to you in the past. And often what we will do is we will find the things that to us make us feel like we're more attractive. The house, the car, whatever it is that to us seems appealing. Why? So that we might feel better about what we already don't feel good about. And then perfection is a way of dealing with our own anxieties, an insatiable desire to do it right. And where does perfectionism often come from? It often comes from a fear of failure. Because we're afraid of what happened. What will people think if we mess up? What will people think if we let them down? And so we deal with our anxieties by being perfectionist, which actually avoids the present. For the prodigal son, he's certainly bouncing around in many of these. He lives in wild living, pursuing pleasure. I wonder the kind of praise and relationships he have when things are going well, and then suddenly how he feels when that all falls apart. Even in the speech he's preparing, like when he's going back to his father, you can see it's kind of based in productivity. Like he's not going to be called a son of the father, but he can be a servant. Like he at least can be useful to his dad, needed by him. And so even in all of it, all of these false versions of himself come to the surface. And when he is in the mud eating with the pigs, he describes what I would describe as a Lion King moment. If you've ever seen the movie Lion King, there's this moment. Now, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen the movie, you are far too late, so I don't care. But in the movie, Simba, he goes on this journey of trying to find himself. Now, it's not like the prodigal son because he's not going off in wild living, but it's perhaps the saddest scene of all time in Disney movies when he loses his father. And so in losing his father, he's trying to figure out who he really is. And so there's this moment where Simba is on this journey. He leaves home to figure himself out, and then Rafiki the baboon whacks him in the head with a stick, right? He whacks him in the head and he says, I'm not the one who's confused, you are. You don't even know who you are. For Simba, he needs that whack in the head to get him to come to his senses. For the younger son, the moment he's in the pig pit, I think is that whack in the head. That he needs that moment to come to his senses, to realize who he really is. Something to shake him out of the false selves that he's been living as. And I don't know what it will be for you that whacks you on the side of the head. I don't know what it will be that gets you to realize that, oh, I don't know who I really am. Maybe it will be losing everything. I hope not. But maybe it is losing the things that you are holding so tightly to. Maybe it will be a broken relationship where you lose somebody you care about and you're realizing, I don't know who I am. Maybe it will be more simple. Maybe it will just be a conversation that seemed much needed and just at the right time. It's like, oh, I needed to hear that. And so Simba, in that moment when he gets whacked on the head, the thing that becomes revealing for him, he looks in the water and he sees his father. He sees himself in his father. He's Mufasa's boy. And I can't help but think of the story that Jesus tells in a similar kind of way. Is he feeding the pigs, and then does he go over to get some water because he's dying of thirst? And does he look in the water and see his own reflection? And in the reflection, he sees the face of his father. He sees that he's his father's son. And then does that lead him to begin asking the kind of questions maybe he should go back? I don't know what it is for you that will cause you to stop long enough to look at the reflection. But my hope is that you will see that reflection, that you will look in the water and see, I'm a son of my father. I am a daughter of God. My hope is that you slow down just long enough to begin to see that maybe God has seen something in you that you haven't been able to see for yourself. And so the son comes home because he realizes that he's a son. And now he's certainly preparing that he wouldn't be treated like a son. In fact, he's preparing the speech. He just wants to be a servant. The son says to the father in verse 21, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Right? So he's still it's not like he's suddenly confident in who he is at this point. He's still like, I am not good enough for my dad. Like, he still feels like he needs to prove it. But you know what's so powerful for us? Because we do the same thing. We still feel not good enough. We still feel like we are trying to measure up. We're still feeling like we need to perform for God's approval. But you may not feel worthy, but your feelings of worth don't actually determine what the Father says. The Father's response is no relation to what the son did or didn't do. It wasn't based on how good his speech was. It wasn't based on all the bad decisions he just made. The Father sees his son. He hikes up his robe and just runs out to meet him. And the Father says to his servants, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. The father starts the party because the son finally came to his senses and realized what he had all along. It didn't change how the father felt. The father felt this way from the start. And the son is finally coming home and going to finally be able to be alive. And the son knew that the day he came home. The first time he ever brought him home. And maybe for some of you, the invitation that you are getting is to come back home. And he's waiting. He is on the porch looking out. He's already got the music turned up. He's just waiting to see you in the distance. He's got the grill on. The party is about to start. Because he's always seen it in you. He saw it in you before you were born. He always had the name for you. Even on the days where you didn't see it in yourself. Even on the days and the moments where you felt unworthy, even on the days where you feel like there is nothing you want to do with him, he's always seen it in you. And he is inviting you to come back home. And he is ready to throw a party, and the party's not because of what it does for him. The party is because he knows what it means for you. The party is because he knows the peace that you will experience knowing who you really are. Because he knows the advantage you will have being able to live at home in relationship with him. He knows what it will look like and how you live in a world when you're secure that you are loved and known by God. Let me pray for us. Jesus, we thank you that you are a God who loves us, that even in the moments we feel not good enough and we feel unworthy and we look for all sorts of ways to deal with our own fears and pain and sin. God, we thank you that you invite us back home. We thank you that you call us back to you. God, I pray that you would help us to see ourselves the way that you see us. That we would be able to see the ways that you're proud of us. That we would hear the truths that you speak over us instead of the lies we believe about ourselves. God, I pray that you would help us to see the party that you are ready to throw because you've seen it in us all along. God, thank you for loving us and for seeing who you made us to be.